front pages. For the next hour, Chris will bring you the front page news from the morning newspapers. The latest headlines from around the state and around the rest of the world.
Hello, everybody. Today is Saturday, April 20th. I am Bill Murphy here with the front pages. I'll be reading from the New York Times and the Hartford Courant. And we will take a look at the pictures on the front page of each paper. The main picture on the front page of the Times is a picture of Narendra Modi. And he is a heavy favorite to win a third term as prime minister in the vote that began on Friday. I guess it's going to take more than one day. This is in India. And there's a picture of him standing in front of a throng of people. And that's about all this. Many people, probably hundreds, and he's in the front there. So we're going to read that story. And a cute little picture over on the front page of the Hartford Current. The headline is Duck, Duck, Goat. John Asher, he's 12 years old, he's checking a photo he took while his brother Jacob, who is 7, and they're both from East Longmeadow, Massachusetts, uses a feather to get one of the ducks' attention. And this took place at the Northwest Park Nature Center's Animal Barn in Windsor. And it says the brothers were visiting the Nature Center with their aunt, and they're kneeling outside the pen where the ducks are, and the older boy, as I said, is checking a photo that he took. He has his camera in his hand. And another cute little picture, a little six-month-old girl, Sophia Aldrich, is with her mother, and she's standing there. They're both from Enfield. They're visiting the goats at the animal barn. Rachel brought her daughter and nephews to take advantage of the weather, it says. And she's standing in front of the pen where the goats are. So those are the main pictures. We're going to read that story about the election in India. It's in Ghaziabad, India. As he campaigns across India for an election that began on Friday, Prime Minister Narendra Modi speaks of his insatiable ambitions in terms of dinner table appetite. Roofs overheads, water connections, cooking gas cylinders. Mr. Modi reads down the menu of what he calls the abundant development he has provided to Indians poor. But he's not stopping there. What Modi has done so far is just the appetizer, he said at one stop, referring to himself in the third person as he often does. The main course is yet to come. That was a quote. To Mr. Modi's legions of supporters, a third term would bring more of what they find so appealing in him. He is that rare breed of strong man who keeps an ear to the ground. He is a magnetic figure and a powerful orator. He has built an image as a tireless and incorruptible worker for a country on the rise. But to his critics, Mr. Modi's talk of a main course is an alarm bell for the future of the world's largest democracy. Mr. Modi, 73, enters the election a heavy favorite. His party's grip over India's more populous northern and central heartlands firmer than ever. The opposition in the same decisive geography even more diminished. Yet even with... I'm just going to repeat that last paragraph. Mr. Modi, 73, enters the election a heavy favorite. His party's grip over India's more populous northern and central heartlands firmer than ever. The opposition in the same decisive geography even more diminished. Yet even with his place as India's unrivaled leader seemingly secured, he has carried out a crackdown on the dissent that has only intensified. And in the lead-up to the voting, which will run for 6 weeks before results are announced on June 4th, agencies under Mr. Modi's control have frozen the bank accounts of the largest opposition party. The leaders of two opposition-run states have been thrown in jail in cases they call politically motivated. The capital region, New Delhi, is currently governed by a chief minister who sends his directives from behind bars. All of this, Mr. Modi's critics say, shows the penchant for full control that has become evident over his decade as prime minister. Mr. Modi, they contend, will not stop until he has turned India's democracy into a one-party rule. Power is being aggressively consolidated around the cult of the leader's personality, said Yamini Ajar, a policy analyst in New Delhi. The deep centralization of power has significantly undermined institutional checks and balances baked into India's democratic structure, Ms. Ajar said. Many Indians seem willing to accept this. Mr. Modi has remained deeply popular even as he has become more autocratic. He has paid little price, even found support for his effort to remake India into what analysts have called an illiberal democracy. He exploits contradictions. The right to vote is held as sacred in the country whose democracy has offered protection in a turbulent region. But polling also indicates that large numbers of Indians are willing to cede civil liberties to support a powerful ruler they see as getting things done. Another seemingly incongruity, people who speak of their own economic strife also often express faith in Mr. Modi's running of the country's affairs, a testament to the forceful narratives he weaves. Indians have more tangible reasons to back him, too. Mr. Modi relentlessly tends his broad support base through generous offerings across society, favorable deals for the business elite in a growing economy, robust welfare programs for India's impoverished majority, and a strong dose of Hindu nationalism for those in between. A campaign stop this month in his party's stronghold of Uttar illustrated this winning formula. I'll just read this one paragraph where he was. Mr. Modi stood in the back of a saffron-colored truck as it moved slowly down a shopping street lined with global brands and jewelry shops, a scene that spoke to the new wealth that has lifted millions of Indians into the middle class. Overhead, billboards with pictures of Mr. Modi, his face is everywhere in India, told of achievements like the installation of more than 100 million toilets for the poor and Indians' rising stature. At the end of the roadshow, at the junction where Mr. Modi's vehicle turned right and headed back to Delhi, was a stage set up with loudspeakers. As Hindu nationalist songs blared, actors dressed up as the deities Ram and Sita posed for selfies with the crowd. And we're going to stop that article there and go over now to the Hartford Current. And I have a few articles that are on the front page of the Current. We'll start with this one. As Connecticut municipalities bear the financial load of early voting, legislative leaders and state officials are split over whether the state should help fund the program and if failing to do so would put elections at risk. With a presidential election looming, House Speaker Matt Ritter indicated Thursday that cities and towns should not expect the legislature to fund early voting this session. Ritter said the early voting was not widely used by Connecticut voters during the April presidential primary. The speaker said the state should hold off on funding decisions until after the 2024 presidential election when more data on early voting participation will be available. If we find the municipalities are grossly underfunded and are unable to carry out their constitutional responsibilities, we'll talk to them, Ritter said. In the meantime, Ritter suggested that cities and towns in need of funds pull from their share of municipal aid from the state. Ritter said that for most municipalities, the costs associated with early voting are probably in the tens of thousands of dollars, not hundreds. Let's just see where we are next year, Ritter said. No municipality is going to go bankrupt. House Republican leader Vincent Candelora said he's strongly disagreeing with Ritter's offer. It's a risk to democracy, Candelora said. It's allowing for the integrity of the system to break down without the proper funding. Candelora said he would like to see the legislature allocate at least another $3 million to assist municipalities with early voting expenses, but said that number could grow to upwards of $10 million. Candelora suggested that the state should use its remaining American Rescue Plan Act funds to cover the bill. If there's an ARPA fund that is still left, if there is a budget that we are going to be looking at. We should be putting more money into early voting, Candelora said. We're going into the wake of a presidential election. We are going to need the staff to support it. When probed on the state's ARPA balance earlier in the day, Ritter said he believes Connecticut's unspent funds are comfortably over $300 million, after joking that every day the paperboy brings more. At the start of the 2024 session, Secretary of the State Stephanie Thomas requested $5 million from the state legislature to alleviate the financial burden of early voting municipalities. Thomas said Thursday that changes to state election laws and low civic literacy have created a perfect storm in Connecticut ahead of the presidential election. We are seeing unprecedented attacks on our elections through foreign bad actors seeking to sow distrust, the proliferation of misinformation and disinformation, and now artificial intelligence, Thomas said in a statement to The Current. My office will continue seeking smart partnerships and alternative funding sources to help the voters of Connecticut exercise their right to vote, and I am hopeful that state investment will follow. And I have another story on the front page of The Current. A Connecticut man's estate was awarded $5.5 million after his complaint of diarrhea ended in a ruptured intestine, sepsis, and a fatal heart attack, according to a recent jury's decision. The attorney representing his estate and his widow said surgery to treat a lack of blood flow to his intestine would have saved his life. Felix Mejia, 69, went to Stanford's Hospital Emergency Department on September 18, 2018, complaining of diarrhea and cramping, saying he had not been eating and had lost weight, according to the lawsuit filed in Superior Court in Stanford. The suit, filed by his wife, Angela Katavid, against emergency medicine physicians of the New Haven County, Dr. Ryosuke Ido and Vanny Mangle, a physician assistant, alleged wrongful death for negligence, not providing Mejia with proper diagnosis and care. Stanford Hospital was not ultimately a defendant in the lawsuit. On the first day, September 18, 2018, they diagnosed him with something called traveler's diarrhea, which is essentially an infection of your intestine, because he had just been in Columbia, where he's from originally, said Michael Kennedy of Kennedy, Johnson, Schwab, and Roberts, who represented Mejia's estate, and Katavid Mejia was told to see his primary care doctor. 4 days later, he returned to the hospital where imaging showed he had chronic mesenteric ischemia, Kennedy said, though that diagnosis was never made, and he was ultimately discharged from the hospital on the 22nd, he said. Chronic mesenteric ischemia occurs when the blood supply fails to meet the demands of visceral organs, usually resulting in acute pain, according to the National Library of Medicine. The lawsuit says Mejia's superior mesenteric artery, a major vessel that supplies blood to the intestine, was constricted. Chronic mesenteric ischemia, Kennedy said, is a heart attack of your intestine. The vessels supplying blood to the intestines become narrowed through plaque buildup, and the bowels do not get the amount of oxygen needed. Eventually, the tissues start dying, Kennedy said, and when that happens, it can be a catastrophic event for a patient. The intestine can perforate and lead to bowel contents going into the abdomen, causing septic shock and ultimately a patient's death, and that's exactly what happened to Mr. Mejia. Our claim was that he should have remained in the hospital at that time, that Dr. Ito and P.A. Mangle, that's physical associate Mangle, had failed to make a diagnosis of chronic mesenteric ischemia, failed to appreciate the seriousness of the condition, and that he needed to remain in the hospital for at least obtain a vascular surgery consult in the emergency room to determine what treatment he needed and how quickly he needed it, Kennedy said. A vascular surgeon would have recommended a procedure to repair some blood vessels, providing blood flow to his intestines on an expeditious basis, he said. But unfortunately, when he was discharged, he just continued to have those gastric symptoms, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and his condition only worsened. By the time he comes back 3 days later, it's finally diagnosed, he's in such a worse position that it's going to take longer to get him ready for that procedure he needed, and ultimately, he never made it. We're going to take a break for this weather and the national forecast from the New York Times, and then I will have the local forecast. Here's the national forecast. Rain and thunderstorms may cause flooding from central Texas east, northeastward to western Mississippi today. Spotty afternoon thunderstorms may develop from southeastern Alabama to the outer banks of North Carolina. Showers will dampen parts of New England and upstate New York. Morning snow showers will occur from the Arrowhead of Minnesota through the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. A steadier snow will come to an end during the morning in eastern Colorado and western Nebraska. In slightly warmer air, occasionally there will be rain and drizzle, and it will fall from southwestern Kansas to the Texas Panhandle. Those locations are also expected to dry out in the afternoon. Meanwhile, the first heat wave of the year will get underway in the desert southwest. And here's the local weather. Saturday today will be 64. That'll be the high. Little rain early in the morning, then clearing. Sunday, it will be partly sunny, and the high will be 60. Mostly sunny on Monday. The high will be 58. On Tuesday, the high will be 61. On Wednesday, it'll be partly sunny and mostly cloudy. Showers around in the p.m. on Wednesday. The high will be 61. And we're going to go back to the front page of the Hartford Courant. This is a local story based on concerns about potential harm to local businesses. West Hartford is dropping the idea of allowing only parallel parking in the town center as a way of freeing up space for wider sidewalks and more outdoor dining. Suggestions to make LaSalle Road a pedestrian-only plaza or one-way street are also off the table, and planners have concluded that adding bike lanes on Farmington Avenue isn't a priority. Plans for the makeover of Central Connecticut's busiest town center had started off with a variety of relatively revolutionary ideas for making the streets much more pedestrian and bicycle-friendly, largely at the expense of car and truck traffic. But a public survey in the winter showed less appetite than expected for the biggest changes. Merchants and restaurateurs told Santec, the town's consultant, that large-scale changes in traffic flow and parking rules could harm their businesses, so the town is looking to a less dramatic plan for improving the Farmington Avenue and LaSalle Road area, town manager Rick Ledwith said at a public debate meeting on April 8th. West Hartford had floated several ideas for modernizing the street and sidewalk system in the center, including the possibility of ending diagonal parking along LaSalle as a way to allow for more pedestrian amenities. But based on public reaction, the town is looking to do a less severe makeover now. This is not as aggressive a plan as we had in the fall, Ledwith said. The changes were made this winter after consultants and town staff reviewed hundreds of responses to a survey asking residents, business owners, workers, and visitors about what's most important to them in the town center. Calling the new proposal a hybrid, Ledwith said it was nevertheless important in improving the center. Consultants said the new plan would improve the parking shortage, reduce accidents, replace decaying sidewalks, and address the stress on large trees that provide a canopy for pedestrians. And I have one more story in the front page of the Courant. This is about the vote that they took yesterday in the House about aid to Ukraine and Israel. This is from Washington. With rare bipartisan momentum, the House pushed ahead Friday on a foreign aid package of $95 billion for Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, and humanitarian support as a robust coalition of lawmakers helped it clear a procedural hurdle to reach final votes this weekend. Friday's vote produced a seldom-seen outcome in the typically hyper-partisan House, with Democrats helping Republican Speaker Mike Johnson's plan advance 316 to 94. Final House approval could come this weekend when the package would be sent to the Senate. It was a victory for the strategy Johnson set in motion this week after he agonized for 2 months over the legislation. Still, Johnson has had to spend the past 24 hours making the rounds on conservative media, working to salvage support for the wartime funding, particularly for Ukraine, as it faces a critical moment battling Russia, but also for his own job as the effort to remove him as Speaker grew. Ukrainians desperately need lethal aid right now. We cannot allow Vladimir Putin to roll through another country and take it, Johnson told the conservative host of the Mark Levin Show about the Russian president's invasion of Ukraine. These are very serious matters with global implications. Johnson said after the vote that while it wasn't perfect legislation, it was the best possible product Republicans can get, given their thin majority in one chamber of Congress. After months of delay, the House worked slowly but deliberately once Johnson made up his mind this week to plow ahead with a package that matches, with a few alterations, what the Senate passed in February. President Joe Biden sent a swift endorsement of the Speaker's plan in a rare moment. Donald Trump, the Republican presumed presidential nominee who opposes most overseas aid for Ukraine, has not derailed the Speaker's work. The world is watching what the Congress does, the White House said in a statement. Passing this legislation would send a powerful message about the strength of American leadership at a pivotal moment. In an extremely rare step, members of the House Rules Committee joined forces late Thursday in a near-midnight vote, the four Democrats giving their support on a procedural step to push past the Republican majority's three hardline holdouts to send the package to the House floor for debate on a 9-3 vote. It was a moment unseen in recent House memory. And we're going to move on now to more news from the current. This is from Juneau, Alaska. The Biden administration said Friday that it will restrict new oil and gas leasing on 13 million acres of a federal petroleum reserve in Alaska to help protect wildlife such as caribou and polar bears as the Arctic continues to warm. The decision, part of a years-long fight over whether and how to develop the vast oil resources in the state, finalizes protections first proposed last year as the Democratic administration prepared to approve the contentious Willow Oil Project. The approval of Willow drew fury from environmentalists who said the large oil project violated President Joe Biden's pledge to combat climate change. Friday's decision also completes an earlier plan that called for closing nearly half the reserve to oil and gas leasing. A group of Republican lawmakers, led by Alaska Senator Dan Sullivan, jumped out ahead of Friday's announcement about the new limitations in the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska before it was publicly announced. Sullivan called it an illegal attack on the state's economic lifeblood, and he predicted lawsuits. It's more than a 1-2 punch to Alaska, Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican of Alaska, said, because when you take off access to our resources, when you say you cannot drill, you cannot produce, you cannot explore, you cannot move it, this is the energy insecurity that we're talking about. The decision by the Interior Department doesn't change the terms of existing leases in the reserve or affect currently authorized operations, including Willow. The Biden administration also recommended the rejection of a state corporation's application related to a proposed 200-mile road in the northwest part of the state to allow mining of critical mineral deposits, including copper, cobalt, zinc, silver, and gold. There are no mining areas in the area, and the U.S. Bureau of Land Management determined that the road building alternatives analyzed, this is a quote, would significantly and irrevocably impact resources, unquote. The agency said that in a statement. A final decision on the recommendation is pending. And we are now going to move over to the World and Nations section. From New York, a full jury of 12 people and six alternates were seated Friday in Donald Trump's hush money case, setting the stage for opening statements next week in the first criminal trial of a former president, U.S. president. Hours later, An appeals court judge rejected Trump's last-minute bid to halt the trial over his claims that jury selection was unfairly rushed. The jury, which includes a software engineer, investment banker, English teacher, and multiple lawyers, took final shape after lawyers spent days quizzing dozens of potential jurors on whether they can impartially judge the presumptive Republican presidential nominee. The judge said lawyers will present opening statements Monday morning before prosecutors begin laying out their case, alleging a scheme to cover up negative stories Trump feared would hurt his 2016 presidential campaign. The trial in Manhattan thrust Trump's legal problems into the heart of his hotly contested race against President Joe Biden, with the latter likely to seize on unflattering and salacious testimony to make the case that Trump is unfit to return as commander-in-chief. Trump, meanwhile, is using the prosecution as a political rallying cry, casting himself as a victim while juggling his dual role as criminal defendant and presidential candidate. Just after the jury was seated, emergency crews responded to a park outside the courthouse where a man had set himself on fire. The man spread pamphlets espousing conspiracy theories around the park before dousing himself in a flammable substance and setting himself aflame. Officials said he was in critical condition Friday afternoon. Trump has spent the week sitting quietly in the courtroom as lawyers pressed potential jurors on their views about him in a search for any bias that would preclude them from hearing the case. During breaks in the proceedings, he has railed against the case on social media or to TV cameras in the hallway, calling it a politically motivated witch hunt. Over 5 days of jury selection, dozens of people were dismissed from the jury pool after saying they didn't believe they could be fair. Others expressed anxiety about having to decide such a consequential case without seismic media attention, even though the judge has ruled that jurors' names will be known only to prosecutors, Trump, and their legal teams. One woman who had been chosen to serve on the jury was dismissed Thursday after she raised concerns over messages she said she got from friends and family when aspects of her identity became public. On Friday, another woman broke down in tears while being questioned by a prosecutor about her ability to decide the case based only on evidence presented in court. I wouldn't want someone who feels like this to judge my case either, the woman said. I don't want to waste the court's time. From Washington, the Biden administration imposed sanctions Friday on two entities accused of fundraising for extremist Israel settlers already sanctioned, as well as the founder of an organization whose members regularly assault Palestinians. The Treasury Department announcement comes as the West Bank has seen some of its worst violence perpetrated by extremist settlers against Palestinians since the war in nearby Gaza began. There was also friction between President Joe Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, whose far-right government has reacted angrily to previous sanctions imposed against West Bank settlers. Included in the Friday sanctions are two entities, Mount Hebron Fund and Shalom Esaraic, accused of raising money for sanctioned settlers Yunan Levy and David Chai Chestai. Both men were previously sanctioned by the Biden administration for attacking Palestinians in the West Bank. The penalties aim to block them from using the U.S. financial system and bar American citizens from dealing with them. The fundraising campaign established by Mount Hebron Fund for Levy and by Sholan Esarak for Chastai generated the equivalent of $140,000 and $31,000, respectively, according to the U.S. Treasury. In Levy's case, the fund, now sanctioned by the Biden administration, is linked to the Regional Council in the area, a body that receives state money. The Biden order Friday stopped short of sanctioning the council itself. Rights groups say the expansion of illegal settler outposts in the West Bank is enthusiastically supported by the regional councils and nudged along by Israel's national government, the most far right in the country's history. This Biden order also skirted sanctioning crowdfunding websites where money was raised, Give Chalk and New York-based charity. In Shasai's case, the fundraiser on charity was organized by Shalom Azariah, which raises money for imprisoned Jewish extremists. Both online fundraisers have now been taken down, but at least one fundraiser linked to a settler previously sanctioned by the Biden administration, Mosby Sharbat, remains online. As of Friday, the page on GiveChuck had raised the equivalent of more than $879,000. Treasury Deputy Secretary Wally Adamaio said the organizations undermine the peace, security, and stability of the West Bank. And continuing with the front pages from Jerusalem, Israel and Iran on Friday both played down an apparent Israeli airstrike near a major air base and nuclear site in central Iran, signaling the bitter enemies are ready to prevent their latest eruption of violence from escalating into a full-blown regional war. But the indecisive outcome of weeks of tensions, which included an alleged Israeli strike that killed two Iranian generals, an unprecedented Iranian missile barrage on Israel, and the apparent Israeli strike early Friday in the heart of Iran, did little to resolve the deeper grievances between the foes and left the door open to further fighting. It appears we're closer than ever to a broad regional war, despite the fact that the international community will most likely make a great effort to de-escalate tensions, wrote Amos Harrell, the military affairs commentator for the Israeli Daily Haaretz. Israel has long considered Iran to be its greatest enemy, citing the Islamic Republic's calls for Israel's destruction, its controversial nuclear program, and its support for hostile proxies across the Middle East. These tensions have risen since Hamas and Islamic Jihad, Iranian-backed Palestinian groups, attacked Israel on October 7th, sparking a devastating Israeli offensive in Gaza that has continued for more than 6 months. Hezbollah, an Iranian-backed proxy in Lebanon, immediately began striking Israeli targets, opening up tit-for-tat fighting along a second front, while Iranians-backed militias in Iraq, Syria, and Yemen have also fired missiles and drones at Israel throughout the war. While Israel and Iran have waged a shadow war for years, mostly in neighboring Syria, they have largely avoided direct confrontations. That changed after an April 1st airstrike killed two Iranian generals at an Iranian diplomatic compound in the Syrian capital of Damascus. Although Israel did not comment, Iran blamed Israel for the strike and vowed revenge. Iran responded with its first ever direct attack on Israel, launching over 300 missiles and attack drones last Saturday night. Israel, working with a U.S.-led international coalition, said it intercepted 99% of the incoming fire, though a handful of missiles managed to land, causing military base and wounding a young girl. In Friday's attack, Iranian state television said the air defense batteries fired in several provinces over reports of drones in the air. Iranian Army Commander General Abdulrahim Mousavi said crews targeted several flying objects. The explosion this morning in the sky of Isfahan was related to the shooting of air defense systems at a suspicious object that did not cause any damage, Mousavi said. We have another story here from Washington. The Environmental Protection Agency on Friday designated two forever chemicals that have been used in cookware, carpets, and firefighting foams as hazardous substances, an action intended to ensure quicker cleanup of the toxic compounds and require industries and others responsible for contamination to pay for its removal. Designation as a hazardous substance under the Superfund law doesn't ban the chemicals known as PFOA and PFOS, but it requires that releases of the chemical into soil and water be reported to federal, state, or tribal officials if they meet or exceed certain levels. The EPA then may require cleanups to protect public health and recover costs that can reach tens of millions of dollars. PFOA and a PFOS have been voluntarily phased out by U.S. manufacturers but are still in limited use and remain in the environment because they do not degrade over time. The compounds are part of a larger cluster of forever chemicals known as PFAS that have been used since the 1940s in industry and consumer products, including non-stick frying pans, water repellent, sports gear, stain-resistant rugs, and cosmetics. The term PFAS is short for per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. The chemicals can accumulate and persist in the human body for long periods. Evidence from animal and human studies indicates that exposure to PFOA or PFOS may lead to cancer or other health problems, including liver and heart damage and developmental problems in infants and children. President Joe Biden's administration understands the threat that forever chemicals pose to the health of families across the country, EPA Administrator Michael Regan said. Designating these chemicals under our Superfund authority will allow EPA to address more contaminated sites, take earlier action, and expedite cleanups, all while ensuring polluters pay for the cost to clean up pollution threatening the health of communities. The rights of LGBTQ students will be protected by federal law, and victims of campus sexual assault will gain new safeguards under rules finalized Friday by the Biden administration. The new provisions are part of a revised Title IX regulation issued by the Education Department, fulfilling a campaign pledge by President Joe Biden. He had promised to dismantle rules created by then Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, who added new protections for students accused of sexual misconduct. Notably absent from Biden's policy, however, is any mention of transgender athletes. The administration originally planned to include a new policy forbidding schools from enacting outright bans on transgender athletes, but that provision was put on hold. The delay is widely seen as a political maneuver during an election year in which Republicans have rallied around bans on transgender athletes in girls' sports. Instead, Biden is officially undoing sexual assault rules put in place by his predecessor, Donald Trump. The final policy drew praise from victims' advocates, while Republicans said it erodes the rights of accused students. The new rule makes crystal clear that everyone can access schools that are safe, welcoming, and that respect their rights, Education Secretary Miguel Cardona said. No one should face bullying or discrimination just because of who they are or who they love. Sadly, this happens also often. Biden's regulation is meant to clarify schools' obligations under Title IX, the 1972 Women's Rights Law that outlaws discrimination based on sex in education. It applies to colleges and elementary and high schools that receive federal money. The update is to take effect in August. Among the biggest changes is new recognition that Title IX protects LGBTQ students, a source of deep conflict with Republicans. From Baltimore, salvage crews at the site of the collapsed Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore are turning their focus to the thousands of tons of debris sitting atop the Dally, a massive cargo ship that veered off course and caused the deadly catastrophe last month. An estimated 3,000 to 4,000 tons of steel and concrete landed on the ship's deck after it crashed into one of the bridge's supporting columns and toppled the span, officials said at a news conference Friday. Crews will have to remove all that before refloating the stationary ship and guiding it back into the port of Baltimore. Officials displayed overhead photos of the ship with an entire section of fallen roadway crushing its bow. So far, cranes have lifted about 120 containers from the Dally, with 20 more to go before workers can build a staging area and begin removing pieces of the mangled steel and crumbling concrete. The ship was laden with about 4,000 containers and headed for Sri Lanka when it lost power after leaving Baltimore. As the salvage operations continue alongside federal and law enforcement investigations, Maryland Governor Wes Moore said getting the bridge rebuilt is an urgent priority. The 1.6-mile span connected working-class communities on either side of Baltimore's harbor, allowing steelworkers and longshoremen to easily traverse the Patapsco River without driving through downtown and providing a vital route for East Coast truckers. In the meantime, crews are working to reopen the port's main channel, which has been blocked since the collapse, using massive floating cranes. They've carted away about 1,300 tons of steel and counting, officials said. And I have a couple of news briefs. This one, federal officials are resolved to never allow a terrorist attack like the Oklahoma City bombing to happen again. Deputy Homeland Security Advisor Caitlin Derkovich told survivors and loved ones Friday of the 168 people killed in the April 19, 1995 bombing. What happened here in Oklahoma still rests heavy in our hearts. What transpired here 29 years ago remains the deadliest act of homegrown terrorism in U.S. history. Derkovich said in front of a field of 168 bronze chairs, each engraved with the name of a bombing victim at the Oklahoma City National Memorial and Museum. The nearly 90-minute ceremony began with 168 seconds of silence for each of those killed that ended with the reading of the names of each victim. Derkovich was joined by Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland, Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt, Oklahoma City Mayor David Holt for the ceremony on a partly sunny, cool, and windy morning for the 29th anniversary of the attack on the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building downtown. This is a place where Americans killed Americans, and the lessons learned about the bombing should be used to address the political vitriol of today, Holt said. Hatred of the federal government motivated former Army soldier Timothy McVeigh and co-conspirator Terry Nichols to commit the act. And I have one more news briefing. Ukraine's Air Force claimed Friday to have shot down a Russian strategic bomber, but Moscow officials said the plane crashed in a sparsely populated area due to a malfunction after the combat mission. Neither claim could be independently verified. Previous Ukrainian claims of shooting down Russian warplanes during their more than two-year war have met with silence or denials from Moscow. Ukraine said the Air Force and military intelligence cooperated to bring down the 222M3 bomber with anti-aircraft missiles. The Russian Defense Ministry said the warplane crashed in a deserted area in the southern region of Stavropol, hundreds of miles from the Ukraine border. Three crew members ejected from the aircraft and were rescued in a search for a fourth was taking place, according to the ministry, but Stavropol Governor Vladimir Badalimrov said one of the rescue pilots died. And we're going to move on now to the Connecticut section for the rest of our stories. Two people have been arrested on larceny and conspiracy charges for allegedly dismantling nearly half a mile of railroad tracks used for the Essex steam train and selling the metal to a number of scrapyards. Nicole S. Hukirk, 38, and Jason A. Hubbard, 47, both of Clinton, were charged this month after Environmental Conservation Police identified them as suspects in a theft reported in February at the Connecticut Valley Railroad State Park in Old Saybrook, according to the State Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. NCON police began investigating on February 26th after learning that two individuals were seen dismantling and removing sections of railroad track behind Tractor Supply in Old Saybrook, according to the DEEP. The Connecticut Valley Railroad State Park and the railroad tracks have been owned by DEEP since the agency purchased them in 1967. DEEP leases the railroad tracks to the Valley Railroad Company, which operates under the Essex Steam Train and Riverboat. The company runs vintage steam and diesel locomotives and passenger coaches on 12 miles of track. According to DEP, Hukirk and Hubbard dismantled 0.4 miles of track and sold it at various scrap yards. The track was later repaired and restored for safe use. Hukirk and Hubbard were taken into custody April 9th by members of the Clinton Police Department and subsequently charged by NCON police. They each face charges of first-degree damage to railroad property, conspiracy to commit first-degree damage to railroad property, first-degree criminal mischief, conspiracy to commit first-degree criminal mischief, fourth-degree larceny, conspiracy to commit fourth-degree larceny, second-degree reckless and endangerment of, and conspiracy to commit second-degree reckless endangerment. DEP said the suspects were identified following a lengthy investigation by NCON police with the assistance of the Valley Railroad Company. The northbound deck of the Gold Star Memorial Bridge needs to be replaced, and a public information meeting will be held April 30th to provide details about the $591.9 million project and offer an opportunity for questions. The bridge links New London and Groton across the Thames River on Interstate 95. The Gold Star Bridge is a vital structure for New London and Groton residents, major employers, and freight movement along the I-95 corridor, said State Department of Transportation Project Manager Tracy Brays in a statement. The project will address existing bridge deterioration, increase the bridge's load-carrying capacity, and extend its service life, Brace said. We encourage the public to attend this meeting to share their feedback with the CTDOT project team to incorporate it into the design. The project will replace the deck and strengthen the steel superstructure to improve freight travel across the Thames. It will increase the structural capacity of the bridge, improve safety, and continue to meet the traffic demands for the region, according to the statement. The U.S. Naval Submarine Base and the United States Coast Guard Academy are both nearby, and I-95 is a major corridor through New England. Construction will begin in the summer of 2025, assuming funds are available, rights of way are acquired, and permits are approved. The estimated construction cost is $591.9 million, including $158.2 million in Bridge Investment Project grant funds, 90% federal funds, and 10% state funds. It is scheduled to be completed in March of 2029. The Gold Star Memorial Bridge was originally constructed in 1943, and a major superstructure rehabilitation was performed in the 1970s. In the 1990s, multiple rehabilitation projects were completed to improve bridge conditions. In 2014, there was a bearing replacement project for half of the expansion bearings on the approach spans. In 2018, improvements were completed on the southbound span, and in 2020, the project on the northbound span began. And we have another story from the Connecticut section. Enfield Mayor Ken Nelson is facing criticism following comments at a recent town council meeting where he raised the issue of designation of children as special needs and said it was out of control. The comment came after a member of the Enfield chapter of Standing Up for Racial Justice addressed the council with data that points to a disproportionate number of students of color and students with disabilities being arrested or suspended from school in town in the 2022-23 school year. The speaker also noted concerns about academic performance gaps, potential racial biases, and made a call for a deep look at data that would be available to educators for training in implicit bias de-escalation techniques and cultural competency and for an equity study. The speaker also noted that some of the data she cited was readily available publicly on state education websites. I don't care if they are white, black, green, or orange. If they are threatening harm to another student in school, they deserve to be suspended, Nelson said in response. The video shows that falls for special needs, too. Unfortunately, special needs has gotten so out of control in this country that any child that needed a spanking at 2 years old when he's 16 and doesn't want to listen, he's special needs now. The comments upset some parents, and in a written statement to The Current on Thursday, Nelson said he made the comments only in regard to arrests. My comments are solely based on the accusations presented at the council meeting by a member of the public that our Board of Education and Police Department are targeting certain groups and classes of people with the arrests that have happened in the Enfield school system. She has no documentation to back up her comments, Nelson stated. My comment was addressing the arrests and address only. I do not care if you're black, white, green, orange, or special needs. If you threaten harm or harm another student or staff member, you should be arrested. Nelson said he doesn't deny saying special needs designations of children are out of control in the town of Enfield. The Board of Education said that 50% of our students are classified as special needs. Nelson said, I find it unrealistic that students who are on free or reduced lunch or grouped in with children that truly have special needs. I think we're diminishing the definition of special needs, and the parents of the children who actually need services are pushed aside or have to fight for what their children need. The students in Enfield should not have to be in fear of other students. The next time you walk in for a cup of coffee at a popular Hartford coffee roaster, you may also walk out with some new ink. Beans of Parkville Coffee Roaster and Refuge Tattoos have joined together under the same roof to create one of the state's first ever tattoo and coffee shops. The two businesses, both now located at 95 Park Street in Hartford, join a growing list that have opened storefronts on one of the city's most bustling streets. Both businesses celebrated with a ribbon-cutting ceremony Friday morning after an initial weeks-long soft opening. It's a place where people can come in, have conversations, share ideas, and appreciate really beautiful things, said Jack Sullivan, founder of BOP Coffee Roaster. I always thought there was a cool yin and yang energy between tattoos and coffee, because tattoos are these really beautiful permanent thing that is for our visual senses. Coffee is also really beautiful, but a temporary thing that is in your mouth and out in a few hours. So there's this beautiful kind of opposite symmetry. Sullivan, a self-proclaimed coffee lover, has operated a micro coffee roasting operation from his home at 16 New Park Avenue since 2019. Instead of roasting the beans in bulk, the slower process of roasting beans in small batches is thought to result in a product with more flavor and better taste. And it's not just any ordinary run-of-the-mill coffee. Sullivan imports coffee beans from across the world, with offerings from Haiti, Burundi, Tanzania, Uganda, and Brazil, among other countries. Many of his coffee beans are hard to find in other shops, giving him a unique corner of the market. Hartford, which has been called the coffee capital of Connecticut, has seen several coffee shops recently open or expand in the city, so coffee lovers have even more options to get their fix. And my last story. We all know pizza doesn't grow out of the ground, but there is an apropos reason why Pepe Burby has named his latest restaurant Hartford Pizza Garden. In addition to offering three classic pizza styles, including acclaimed New Haven style, Burby and his business partner, Brian Dubay, will hydroponically grow herbs, cherry tomatoes, lettuce, and microgreens right on the premises. The ingredients will be used in their pizza, salads, and pub-style food. I want to create healthier food with my fresh ingredients, Burby said. I'm not keeping this the average pizza place. The restaurant opened just a few weeks, offers three pizza styles, New Haven, Detroit, and Grandma's Pizza, in honor of a now late maternal grandmother of Fern, who raised him. To learn how to make the famous thin-crusted charred New Haven-style pizza, Burby said he visited Sally's, Pepe's, Modern in New Haven, then studied the art of making it on YouTube while he smoked a lot of pot. He calls that pie Hartford, New Haven. His thick-crusted Detroit pizza, a rectangular pie he calls Hartford Square, is made with mozzarella, Wisconsin brick cheese, aged Tuscan pecorino, and topped with hot honey drizzle. It's like a pizza and dessert at the same time, and light and fluffy He said, Grandma's pie is thick crust, Sicilian style, cooked in a sheet pan with the cheese going on before the sauce rather than vice versa. So far, the men are offering 25 toppings, and their best seller has turned out to be a Debbie's Shepherd Pie Pizza named after Burby's late mom, Debbie, because that's all we ate growing up because of poverty, he said. That pie is topped with cheese, ground beef, corn, mashed potatoes, thick gravy, drizzle, salt, and pepper. Burby 46 said the pie is almost magical. I love it. It's my favorite food, he said. It's nostalgic. For 4 years, Burby owned and operated Fiddlehead's Cafe, a farm-to-table breakfast and lunch spot in the same location. He was forced to close that about 2 years ago when there was a disagreement between the building owner and another party. 2 years later, the owner asked if he wanted to come back for much less rent. That's when Harford Pizza Garden was born. Partner Derby handles the business side of the restaurant, and both will work in the kitchen. He says the restaurant is a groovy spot and a nice environment inside and out. It's great giving people something they care about, Derby said. It's rewarding. We have the lottery numbers now for Friday, April 19th. Play 3 day, 1, 3, 2, WB4. Play 4 night, 3, 9, 1, 8, WB7. Thursday's late numbers, play 3 night, 6, 6, 5, WB6. Play 4 night, 3, 5, 6, 3, WB9. Cash 5 numbers, 11, 25, 26, 33, 34. Lucky for life, 4, 10, 16, 44, 45, LB 14. Tonight's estimated Lotto jackpot, $2.3 million. Tonight's estimated Powerball jackpot, $98 million. And on this day, April 20th, in 1912, Boston's Fenway Park hosted its first professional baseball game, while Navin Field, later Tiger Stadium, opened in Detroit. The Red Sox defeated the New York Highlanders 7-6 in 11 innings. The Tigers beat the Cleveland Naps 6-5 in 11 innings. In 1916, the Chicago Cubs played their first game at Wrigley Field, then known as Wheaton Park. The Cubs defeated the Cincinnati Reds 7-6. In 1999, the Columbine High School massacre took place in Colorado as two students shot and killed 12 classmates and one teacher before taking their own lives. And in 2012, a judge ruled that George Zimmerman could be released on a $150,000 bail while he awaited trial on a charge of murdering 17-year-old Trayvon Martin during a February 2012 confrontation in a Sanford, Florida gated community. Zimmerman was acquitted. That is all for the front pages for today. I've been reading from the New York Times and the Hartford Current. My name is Bill Murphy, and we'd like to wish you a very happy weekend, what's left of it, and it looks like the weather is going to be pretty good for the next, actually for the whole week. So enjoy that, and we will see you later. So long for now.